You're listening to special coverage from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm David Green. We are covering the aftermath of the largest mass shooting in United States history. A gunman killed 50 people and wounded 53. Those are the numbers we have so far. This took place at a crowded nightclub in Orlando, Florida, early this morning. NPR has confirmed the gunman was Omar Mateen. He is a 29-year-old American citizen who lived in Central Florida.
It is not clear whether this was an act of terrorism or a hate crime. NPR's Dina Temple Raston has been following the story. She joins us now. Dina, can you just go through what happened?
Well, it's unclear if the gunman actually stormed the club or was already inside and then opened fire. But at about 2 this morning, in fact, shots began ringing out. And the club was crowded with hundreds of people. And the gunman, using an assault rifle, we understand it's an AR-15, just started spraying the crowd. Now, as it turns out, one of the bouncers at the club was an off-duty police officer, and he shot at the gunman, and they started engaging. Police didn't actually get into the club until about 5 a.m., and that's because the gunman, after shooting lots of people, then took several dozen, maybe as many as 30 people hostage in a bathroom and held them there and then began negotiating with police. And according to our sources, the way they initially found out what his name was, this Omar Mateen, is he gave them his name when he began negotiating with them.
So what do we know about this fella?
Well, all we know right now, and it's early days yet, is that he was born here in the U.S. He's of Afghan descent. NBC News contacted his father, and his father said that his son had very strong feelings against gays. And this was a gay nightclub that where the shooting took place. Now, we can't confirm that independently. We do know that officials have been very careful not to connect this prematurely to international terrorism. They're clearly going through Facebook posts and Twitter and his computer to try and find out what motivated the shooting.
Yeah, Dina, when we listen to, the authorities, it sounds like they are being very careful with this right now. And let's listen to one voice here. This is Special Agent Ronald Hopper from the FBI. He was speaking earlier this morning, and he said, as you're saying, they're just not ready to classify what happened as terrorism or a hate crime or anything at this point.
At this point in time, we're just conducting a general investigation period. We'll determine officially whether it's a hate crime or a terrorism incident or even a violent crime once we have all the facts in place. We're at the very early stages, and as much as I would like to give you everything we have, we can't give you things that aren't 100% accurate because then it's not fair to you. So.
Dina, one of the things that has been that I've been interested in, and you spoke about it a little bit, maybe you could tell us more, the police did not go in until 5 o'clock with the SWAT team. They were aware of what is going on. They were paying attention to it. There were police gathered all over the place. Why did it take so long?
What we understand is that there was some negotiation going on between the gunman, now dead, he was killed by a police officer when they actually stormed the building at 5 a.m., and that he was negotiating for something. Now, this is pretty interesting. We don't know what the points of negotiation were and what it is that he wanted, and that might get a little bit to motive. That may be why we're not hearing so much right now about exactly what his motivation was, is because he provided some clues to the police, and the police now have to run those clues down to make sure that they're truthful.
And Dina, what we start throwing around this term possible terrorism. Do you classify it as an incident of terrorism or not? What exactly are the authorities looking at as they think about that word, that classification? Why is that important?
Well, it's important. They're looking right now for any sort of international ties that he might have had. Now, Representative Adam Schiff of the House Committee on Intelligence, he said just recently on CNN that DHS had told him that the Orlando shooter had made a pledge of allegiance to ISIS. But we don't have confirmation of this. And we also don't know when that might have happened and what kind of connections he has. Now, we do know from our own sources that the FBI had looked at him about 3 years ago. And they had looked at what we understand is it wasn't so much that he was doing something specific that worried them or had some ties to terrorism, but rather he had connections with people who the FBI were watching and or were making sure didn't have terrorist connections. So that's what they're sort of pursuing now. That's how we're going to get to the bottom of this.
And I suppose it's worth just recapping the news for people who are just joining us. This is special coverage of what appears to be the largest mass shooting in the history of the United States. It took place early this morning at a nightclub in Orlando, Florida. 50 people have been killed. That number could go up because there are 53 people who are wounded. Many are in a hospital right now, and we're talking with NPR's Dina Temple-Raston. The shooter has been identified as Omar Mateen, a 29-year-old American citizen who lived in Central Florida, and I'm joined here with my co-host Linda Wertheimer. We're going to be taking you through what happened and what we know all morning.
From listening to the things that the authorities have said as they've talked to us and tried to explain what was going on, and the obviously very limited kinds of information, there seem to be two levels of investigation going on. One is that they needed to get to this man's house, they needed to get to his computers, they needed to investigate his car, everything that they can find out about him. That's proceeding on one level. And then on the other level, what they have is what must be a very gruesome scene at this nightclub. They have not, as far as I can tell, yet removed any bodies from the scene. They're trying to find out who these people were and presumably at some point how they died and when they died. And so all of that is going on at the same time. One of the investigations is sort of an intellectual process, and one a very terrible, I'm sure, experience for the people who are going a little bit more, but a little bit more like a massive scale police investigation.
Exactly. It's a crime scene, which is part of the reason why the bodies haven't been removed yet from the club, because they want to make sure that they don't disturb any sort of evidence there. And there's also a reticence to sort of give too many details before they can actually identify who the people are and contact their next of kin. We do know that in Orlando, people are lining up to give blood. This is one of the things that authorities had asked them to do. So the Orlando community is coming out in a big way. But this is not just a sort of a terrorism or a hate crime investigation. This is a crime scene as well. And there are particular steps that you take to make sure that you don't make the investigation more difficult.
So, Dina, this is people who are literally lining up to give blood. I mean, because there's so many injured and so many critically injured who are in the hospital right now, and that might be a desperate need at some point if it's not already.
Yes, they've specifically asked for people to come. Authorities specifically asked for people to come and give blood. They
to
also
blood
asked,
banks. I thought that was interesting. They said, please don't come to the hospital. Go to the blood banks.
Because the hospitals are, you know, quite busy with the wounded. And in addition to that, they've asked anyone who was in the club who might have seen anything at all to contact police authorities, because what might not seem like something very important to you if you were in the club could in fact be a key piece of evidence that the police need. So they've put out a hotline and asked people to call if they were in the club so that they can debrief these people. Now, there were hundreds of people, literally hundreds, 300 people in this club. It's a very small, confined club, but they got that many people in there, and that's what they're looking for, some 200 people who left after the shooting happened.
And Dina, I mean, sadly, you and I have covered things like this before, and I mean, one of the things you see, I mean, you and I were in Paris together after that horrible massacre there. I mean, you watch a city and a community sort of find a way to come together, and it sounds like we're beginning to see that in Orlando this morning.
We are. And until this particular shooting, the worst, if this turns out to be a terrorist attack, the worst terrorist attack in the United States post 9/11 was the Fort Hood shooting. You may recall that Colonel Nidal Hassan opened fire on some unarmed officers at Fort Hood, and 13 died in that attack. So this is on a much, much bigger scale.
NPR's counterterrorism correspondent, Dina Temple-Raston, who will be with us during the course of the day. Dina, thank you.
You're welcome.
And now we are joined by Ada Peralta. He's a correspondent at NPR and has been watching this this story unfold, the deadliest mass shooting in U.S. history. Dina just mentioned Fort Hood. But yeah. That was not the deadliest to this point, was it?
It's not. So the sad numbers are that this now becomes the deadliest mass shooting in U.S. history. Before that, it was Virginia Tech in 2007, which left 33 dead and 17 wounded. And before that, it was in 2012, which I think really a lot of people remember, and it was Sandy Hook Elementary School, where 28 people were killed, mostly children. And then you would have to go back to 1991, which is the Luby's Cafeteria in Killeen, Texas, 24 people dead and 20 wounded. And here we have 50 people dead, lots of people still in the hospital, more than 50 in the hospital. And so by far the most deadly attack.
And those numbers could just keep going up.
That's right.
Depending on how people are doing. We know many of them are in critical condition at that hospital. Ader, among the many voices we've heard this morning, there was an imam who spoke at one of the press conferences. What you were listening in, what did he have to say?
Yeah, it was Imam Mohammed Morsi, who is the president of the Islamic Society of Central Florida. You know, as Dina mentioned, the name of the shooter has not been released publicly, and nobody really talked about the motive behind this.
Well, we've identified him as Omar Mateen, who's
right.
29,
yeah.
U.S.
And,
citizen, right?
But nobody at the press conference was talking about motive. And so the imam actually talked about sort of this broader conversation on mass shootings. And what he said is we as a society have to do something to stop these mass shootings from happening. Today, he said, we've had one more than enough.
He also obviously is there to try to diffuse the possibility that people will instantly connect this to international events. And it is true that we don't know yet whether this is like what happened in Paris, where you were, David,
right,
where there was a considerable amount of international organization, lots of people, lots of planning before the event happened. This feels like, and I say that without any authority at all, a lone wolf event. That's what one of the police who spokesman in Orlando called it, a lone wolf event. What do you think?
That's right. I mean, I think they were alluding to that. Again, we don't have any sort of concrete information about that, but there were allusions to that. I mean, the sheriff in Orlando basically said we're treating this as a terrorism case.
All right, lots to figure out this morning. The authorities are still talking about whether this might be terrorism or a hate crime. The largest mass shooting in U.S. history at a nightclub in Orlando, Florida, early this morning. And this is special coverage from NPR News. This is special coverage from NPR News. With Linda Wertheimer, I'm David Green. We're covering a mass shooting that took place at a nightclub in Orlando, Florida, early this morning. 50 people are confirmed dead at this point. 53 have been injured and are in hospitals right now. And again, this is the largest mass shooting in U.S. history. The shooter, who is dead now, the authorities killed him, and when they went into the club about 3 hours after the gunman started shooting, has been identified as Omar Mateen, a U.S. citizen from Central Florida. We're following all of these events this morning and trying to figure out what we know and what we can still learn as the investigation continues. There are many families who are waiting anxiously to hear about their loved ones who are in that club and are at Orlando hospitals this morning. Many people in Orlando have been turning out to give blood and donate blood to help out as doctors are treating the wounded. Let's turn now to Amy Green. She is a reporter with member station WMFE in Orlando. Amy, it's thank you for coming on. I know it's been a busy morning for you.
Of course, yes. Happy to be here.
You've been getting briefings all morning from the authorities, from community leaders. I mean, can you sort of put together as best you can what we know about what took place early this morning?
Sure. Well, what we know at this point, as you said, David, is 50 dead, 53 injured. And I can tell you that reporters here on the scene, including myself, gasped when the police chief delivered the latest numbers. As you said, it's the worst mass shooting in American history. And officials say that the number of casualties increased because they found more deceased on the scene than they had anticipated when they went into the scene there.
So they were initially thinking, I mean, we were hearing numbers of 20 or so, and they were just stunned to see more bodies when they actually went into that club at what we understand was about 5 in the morning.
That's right. Police Chief John Mina says that first responders were very shocked and that the scene there was very upsetting for the first responders there. He said that was clear in the eyes of the first responders.
Amy, can you just tell us, I mean, I know a lot of people think about Orlando, they think of all the the theme parks. Just sort of orient us, if you can, where exactly is this nightclub? What is the place, what is the place like?
That's right. Well, it's the nightclub is called Pulse, and it's a few blocks south of downtown Orlando. That would make the nightclub several miles, I guess, north and east of the theme parks that so many Americans are so familiar with. Orlando is home to a very vibrant gay community, very well accepted, and this is just a shock, and everyone here is saddened by this.
And how close are you to the nightclub? Have you been able to get close to sort of the police scene that's there right now?
Right. I'm only a few blocks from the nightclub. I'm in a parking lot of a Chipotle restaurant, actually. And this is where officials, police, leaders like Senator Bill Nelson, Governor Rick Scott are briefing reporters on the latest information that's available.
And Amy, just give us a sense of what this community is like right now. I mean, the city of Orlando, I mean, that you know so well and cover, I mean, just has to be in total shock and disbelief.
I would say everyone is just very, very upset, including myself personally. There are calls to donate blood. There is a hotline for family members to call if they're looking for information on loved ones. There is a place where family members can go to, again, get information on loved ones. The entire community is extraordinarily saddened by this.
Okay, and we actually, Amy, stay with us. We actually have Rick Scott, the governor of Florida, who's speaking right now. Let's listen in. Actually, I guess we're going to wait a few minutes to have the governor speak. Amy, what do you expect to hear from the governor? I mean, has he been involved in this so far?
I think what we all are waiting to hear is more information on the suspect. We know that suspect's name is Omar Mateen. He's a Fort Pierce man, and Senator Bill Nelson briefed us only a few minutes ago. He says that it appears Mateen is connected with Islamic radicalism. He's believed to be connected with ISIS. Again, we all are waiting for more information on him.
And again, those are very preliminary things that have been coming out and not confirmed yet. And I guess that's one thing we're hoping to hear more from the governor. And the authorities have been saying all morning they're not sure if this is, you know, connected to national terrorism, if it's a lone wolf, as some have been saying. And these are really important questions that need to be answered.
Of course, of course.
It looks as though, David, that do we have the governor? Can we listen to the governor for a few minutes? Governor Rick Scott has been talking basically in a very sort of the way that you would imagine a political leader would, trying to say comforting things, trying to emphasize that there are things that will that the people have to rally around, people have to stick together. We've heard this all morning from the sheriffs of various counties, the mayors of two communities that are involved. And I think what everybody really wants is information, and it's not clear that they have much more than we do. But here is Governor Rick Scott of Florida.
Right now, this is the time to find out exactly what happened. It's a time to pray for those that have been, that have lost their families, that have lost their lives. Pray for the victims. There's going to be plenty of time to deal with, you know, how our society comes together. But I can tell you, the Orlando area, the Orange County, the state of Florida, we're very resilient. You know, we will come together and do everything we can to help everybody that's been impacted, but also bring this community back together again.
Governor,
I have not talked to him yet.
Governor, can you talk about the bullet points why you issued a state of emergency here in Orange County?
Sure.
And what does that mean for the families and the victims?
Sure. We declared a state of emergency to make sure that all the resources that would be necessary for the city and the county would be necessary. Anything that that would be needed from the state is available immediately. The head of the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, Rick Swearingen, is the coordinating officer, but we worked with the mayors and the sheriffs and the police chief to make sure they have all the resources they need.
Governor, what do you know about what was happening between 2 a.m. when this started and 5 a.m. when it ended?
Law enforcement will answer all those questions. They're having another press conference, I think, at 1:30.
Yes, Governor, do you know how many families of the victims have been contacted at this point?
I know that, again, all that will come out as law enforcement will put all that out, but I know they're working hard to reach every family member, and they have victim advocates, as the state attorney said, to take care of all these families. You just can't imagine it happening. I have daughters, I have grandchildren. I can't imagine this happening to my family.
Will you be meeting with the families yourself, Governor?
It's devastating. You know, you don't want this to happen anywhere in the world, okay? But, you know, I can tell you, law enforcement, our elected officials, the mayors, at the state level, we work coordinator activities hoping this would never happen. We work with the federal government hoping this would never happen. But it's devastating when you see how many people lost their life and just the impact it's going to have on their families. I've got kids and grandkids. You can't imagine.
Governor, will you be meeting with the families yourself, Governor?
I will meet with the families at the appropriate time. Look what they're going through right now.
Governor Scott, we're hearing that there was some kind of impediments this morning in between communication between the families and the hospital staff due to privacy regulations. The White House has been contacted. What role may you play in trying to help facilitate the families being able to connect with those still in the hospital?
I think the way I understand that's been resolved. So.
Is there anything that you can do on a policy level to stop something like this in the future?
We're dealing with a tragedy right now. Our prayers go out to everybody impacted. Law enforcement's doing their job. There will be plenty of time to think about how do we continue to improve our society, and we're going to continue to work on how we do that. Look, we're a resilient state. Bye-bye.
I'll answer you one HIPAA question real quick. So the CEO of the hospital came to me and said they had an issue related to the families that had come to the emergency room. Because of HIPAA regulations, they could not give them any information. So I reached out to the White House to see if we could get the HIPAA regulations waived. White House responded through appropriate channels to waive those so that the hospital could communicate with the families that were there.
You've been listening to a news conference. The voice we heard first was the governor of Florida, Rick Scott, who was talking about the resilience, among other things, the resilience of the state of Florida and the areas around Orlando. We also just heard from Mayor Buddy Dyer, the mayor of Orlando, who was answering, I think, a very specific question about problems that members of the public have had in trying to get to the hospitals and get information from the hospitals. He was pointing out that hospitals have regulations against allowing much of that kind of information to get out. So obviously they are all trying to cope with a terribly difficult situation. We have heard from some of these public officials that they've been bringing in trauma surgeons from around the state, and presumably they'll gather as many people as they need to.
Sounded like some pediatric surgeons, which you would imagine. I mean, they're so desperate to find people who can do emergency
surgery. Right, a pediatric,
surgery.
Yes, right. They mentioned that. And I think they're just trying to, they must be pretty much overwhelmed. I mean, to have to perform surgery of varying degrees of seriousness on dozens of people who all went to the number one trauma center, the one number one trauma center there is.
Well, and just hearing the governor there, Linda, I mean, talking about being asked about those 3 hours between when the gunman started, and Amy Green from member station WMFE, I think, Amy, you're still there, right?
I'm here.
I mean, it's one of the reasons that it sounds like hospitals might be just overwhelmed right now is because, as you said, when police actually got in there at 5 a.m, the number of dead were just so much more than they ever anticipated, which they just weren't ready for this.
That's right. That's how it sounds, David. Yes.
Do you have any sense of what is going on at those hospitals? How many people? How they are able to cope?
We have a team of reporters working on the story, and another reporter is working on that angle of the story. I can only imagine the grief that family members who are at those hospitals are experiencing as they wait for word on the condition of their loved ones.
And just recapping this morning, this is special coverage of what appears to be the largest mass shooting in United States history. It took place at a nightclub in Orlando, Florida, early this morning. The gunman we have identified as Omar Mateen, a U.S. citizen from Central Florida. We are told that he went into this nightclub around 2 in the morning. The authorities were able to get in 3 hours later. They killed the gunman and found many more dead than they expected. It appears that number is 50 at this point. We know 53 others are injured and are at hospitals in Orlando this morning. And Linda and I are joined now in the studio by NPR's Scott Detrow as well. And Scott, we're hearing from Amy Green on the line, on the ground. As you've been following the news and any updates, I mean, what can you tell us at this point as you understand how this all took place?
Well, we heard from the White House earlier today. It was what's kind of become almost the standard procedure, first line of comment from the president. We were told from his press secretary that President Obama is monitoring the situation. He's asking to receive regular updates from the FBI and other federal agencies. President Obama is expected to speak around 1:30 Eastern today.
So about an hour from now, we'll hear from the president, sounds like.
Just that. And he's done this numerous times throughout his presidency, come out and spoken after mass shootings to one degree or another. Of course, we're also in the middle of a presidential campaign season, and mm-hmm. we have seen time and again how large-scale shootings like this really do affect the political trajectory. We've heard from both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, the presumptive nominees from the Democratic and Republican Party. As usual, the first response is on Twitter these days. Hillary Clinton tweeted this morning, "Woke up to hear the devastating news from Florida. As we wait for more information, my thoughts are with those affected by this horrific act." Just recently, we heard from Donald Trump as well. He said, "A horrific incident in Florida, praying for the victims and their families." And a little more political than Hillary Clinton was, he said, "When will this stop? When will we get tough, smart, and vigilant?"
You know, it's so interesting because when you have people who are in hospitals fighting for their lives and families, I mean, you hate to even bring up politics.
Right.
But these mass shootings, they are sort of intertwined in a campaign where a lot of people have been sort of thinking about fears and as you said, President Obama has had to address the nation after mass shootings a number of times during his presidency.
Right, and it seems like the political conversation where both sides kind of dig in and make this about the issues they want to talk about happens faster and faster and faster now, and it's almost near instantaneous on the internet. But just going back to the San Bernardino shootings, we saw that immediately affect what campaigns were talking about, what candidates were talking about, and national securities issues really shot to the top in terms of what voters were worried about and what the campaigns were talking about.
Excuse me. This was supposed to be the week that Hillary Clinton really launched her campaign.
Yes, absolutely. And she is expected as of right now to campaign with Barack Obama in Green Bay, Wisconsin, later this week. I think news of this magnitude often does shake up the campaign calendar, so we'll see whether Hillary Clinton reschedules that event. Another big event that was expected for later this week was Donald Trump on Monday expected to have a big speech really attacking Hillary Clinton, going into her the way that she attacked him a couple weeks ago on national security issues. So again, that's something that, you know, you schedule something, you plan around it, and suddenly the news shifts and it might seem out of sorts and it might seem like something that you want to talk about another
topic.
A little
bit out of phase.
Yeah.
Maybe you need to back off a little bit. But those kinds of things, as we have seen with the politicians from Florida, they're all saying they started this in the very early morning with basic kind of the sorts of things that you would expect. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you could give that speech, I could give that speech.
Yeah, a lot of thoughts and prayers is the phrase that you see in statements from politicians of all levels. Florida Governor Rick Scott did declare a state of emergency. That seemed to happen as he was traveling to Orlando. That's a step that's often taken to help coordinate emergency responses, to help county-level people talk to state-level people, talk to federal-level people. So that's one concrete step that we've seen taken by an official so far.
That's NPR's Scott Detrow, who's in the studio with us this morning. And let's just check in very briefly with a couple more people we have on the line. NPR's Dina Temple-Raston, NPR's counterterrorism correspondent, has been following these events all morning. And Dina, as we look into the hours ahead, what questions are you hoping to have answered as we go forward here?
Well, there are dueling headlines right now as to whether or not this shooter actually had a connection with ISIS or didn't. The Adam Schiff, on the House Intelligence Committee, said he was congressman. Yes, of course. Sorry. He said that he had been told by local law enforcement that the shooter Mateen had actually made a pledge of allegiance to ISIS. But at the exact same time, we're seeing cross the wire, and the sources I'm talking to say that there hasn't been a connection made yet, and they're looking for one, but they haven't seen one. And we're seeing also on pro-ISIS forums lots of pro-ISIS supporters on Twitter saying, applauding the attack, but we haven't seen any sort of claim of responsibility come from ISIS. I think that's what we're waiting to see.
Okay, and we also have Amy Green, a reporter with member station WMFE in Orlando, on the line. And Amy, this is your community. You're watching this community go through something so tragic. What are you hoping to learn in the hours as we go forward here? All right, it sounds like we've lost Amy Green. She has been working diligently all morning to be reporting from the ground. Well, Dina, that potential ISIS connection, I mean, we should be very, very careful because nothing's confirmed yet, but that could be significant as we learn more.
It could, but they also have been very careful not to rule out that this might have been a hate crime. This was a gay bar, one of the most popular gay bars in Atlanta. In Orlando. Mm-hmm. And officials have been really careful to say that they haven't ruled out that this was not some sort of hate crime. And there's an inclination to jump to conclusions here, and we have to be very careful to say that officials on the record have said they are not sure if this was some sort of international terrorism or whether or not this was, in fact, a hate crime.
All right, Linda, I guess we'll be following the news all morning here.
Yeah.
As we have the largest mass shooting in U.S. history.
And we hope you will stay with us. We're going to, we have sent a plane load of people to Orlando, and we're hoping to hear from them soon. We will have a lot of people in and out of the office today, covering various aspects of the story. And thank you very much, Scott, for being with us this hour, and we'll depend upon you to stick with us. This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm David Green. We are covering, sadly this morning, what appears to be the largest mass shooting in this nation's history. There are 50 people dead at a nightclub in Orlando, Florida. A shooter who's been identified as Omar Mateen went into that nightclub, we are told, around 2 o'clock in the morning. There was some sort of hostage situation that took place over the course of 3 hours. The authorities went in. They were able to kill the shooter around 5 o'clock in the morning. A reporter from member station WMFE, Amy Green, has told us that the authorities found far more dead when they entered that nightclub than they ever imagined. And then there are as many as 53 people who have been injured, some critically, who are at hospitals this morning in Orlando. This is a community that is trying to cope with something so shocking and devastating. There are many people in Orlando who are rushing to blood banks to give blood in hopes of being able to help the wounded. And we're going to be covering this story all morning. We are expecting the President of the United States, President Obama, to address the nation in just under an hour from now. And we're in the studio with NPR's Scott Detrow. And Scott, just remind us when the president will be coming out to talk to the nation at the White House. This is something he has done before, sadly, in his presidency.
That's right. We expect to hear from President Obama around 1:30 Eastern. This is something that President Obama has done time and time again over the course of his presidency. Come and speak in the briefing room, speak in the East Room, speak somewhere in the White House, responding to a mass shooting. And it's something that frankly, he's gotten very angry about as he's done that in recent times. Last fall, responding to a community college shooting in Oregon, President mm-hmm. Obama said that this has become routine. This is something that the country has become numb to. And he expressed a lot of anger about that fact. And President Obama has said that the absolute worst day of his presidency was responding to the mass shootings at Sandy Hook Elementary in Connecticut. I believe that was 2012 when that happened. President Obama has spoken several times about how immediately hearing the news, responding that day, and then going up for the funeral service in Connecticut was the absolute bottom barrel of his time in the White House.
And you know, it's when I've been out and you've been out too, talking to Americans, you know, in this election season, it really is stunning that you know, I mean, it doesn't matter sort of what political persuasion you are. Those events like San Bernardino, like Sandy Hook, I mean, they're still very much on people's minds when they think about their fears, when they think about, you know, shootings, when they think about their families, when they think about their views one way or the other on guns. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, you know, there's a lot of disagreement, a lot of debate, but what we can say with certainty is these types of events, I mean, they really do stay with people in a very painful way, it seems, and I'm sure we're going to see that here in the weeks and months ahead.
Yeah, absolutely, and within the context of the presidential campaign, you see that in public opinion polls. When pollsters ask what issues are top of mind for voters, you saw a surge in national security concerns in the wake of the San Bernardino shootings, which, of course, happened, you know, shortly after the attacks in Paris as well. And it's something that in the political realm, President Obama really tried to focus on early in his second term, trying to respond to shootings by pushing forward tightened restrictions on access to guns and screenings for guns. And that's something that he was not able to accomplish at all, that failed to get through Congress. He's expressed a lot of frustration that wasn't able to happen. But this is an issue where both sides are very much dug in. And it seems like that there's another political dynamic as well, where when incidents happen like this more recently, Democrats will want to talk about gun control, and mm-hmm. a lot of Republicans will want to talk about national security measures.
But also
concerns
about
domestic terrorism.
People who feel that in a moment like this, their right to own a gun is even more important. Which
yes.
which sort of, I mean, you hear the reaction to something like this in very very different ways. Well, Scott Detrow, stay with us. We also have NPR's Ada Peralta, who has come into the studio.
Ada, one of the things that you've been paying some attention to is the governor of Florida.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we're sort of talking here about the playbook here, right? We've gone through this so many
yeah.
times, and we know that the president speaks for this, but something different happened today, and that's that the governor of Florida, Rick Scott, declared a state of emergency. It's 50 people dead, and there's a lot of work that involves, you know, identifying the dead, notifying the family. And so he has put the state under emergency to allow local authorities to give them the things they need to do their job. We haven't seen something like this before.
So did you have a sense, was there a Democrat or Republican sense about Rick Scott? I mean, he is a Republican governor of Florida.
No, I think, I mean, you know, he during the press conference, he offered prayers for everybody and said that everybody was in their thoughts and prayers. But one of the things that he did say is, you know, we've been talking a lot about what the motive behind this is. And he was very clear as to what this is. He said, and I'm going to read a little about what he said. He said, this is clearly an act of terror. To take that number of lives and injure that many people, it's clearly an act of terror. And that was Governor Rick Scott, Florida.
I guess you could perhaps make a distinction between terror and international terror.
That's right.
I don't know if that's a real distinction. But so far, we haven't attached this person to any other group.
Right. Authorities have not attached this person to any other groups yet, obviously.
Well, you know, we have someone on the line who actually can speak to this very question, NPR's counterterrorism correspondent, Dina Temple-Raston. And Dina, when we hear public figures say something like act of terror, act of terrorism, what does all this mean? What do these words mean, and are they important?
They are important. And I should say that the definition of terrorism is violence for a political end. So if this turns out to be, for example, the shooter having some sort of bias against gays, that would still be terrorism, violence for a political end.
Mm-hmm.
If it turns out that he has a connection to groups overseas or some sort of terrorism connection with ISIS or another group, still, this would be violence for a political end. So we shouldn't see Governor Rick Scott's words as saying that he thinks that this is an international terrorism link. He's using a very precise term that it's almost a term of art. When you talk about terrorism, it's talking about doing something to frighten people for a political motive.
And so if this turned out to be someone who perhaps was struggling with mental health issues, who was a lone wolf, who did this just because something happened to him personally, I mean, those are the types of instances we talk about that we would not necessarily call them an act of terrorism.
Well, it depends, because even if he was only slightly imbalanced, if he was doing this because he wanted to send some sort of political message, say an anti-gay message, then that would fall under the realm of terrorism. Let me give you a different example. The Aurora Theater shooting that we had. In Colorado. The man who did that was, in fact, a schizophrenic, and he had been, he thought people were out to get him. That wasn't a political end. That was actually a man who wanted to commit violence with no real big message, just this sort of message that was in his mind. That's what would distinguish this, for example, from the Colorado shooting.
And what do we know at this point? I mean, you have brought up the possible link to ISIS that some are throwing around. I mean, what exactly do we know at this moment?
Well, we know very little at this moment, frankly. I mean, there has been some local law enforcement apparently told Representative Adam Schiff, who's on the House Intelligence Committee, that they had found a connection to ISIS, that the shooter had in fact pledged allegiance or bayat to ISIS. But at the same time, we're seeing headlines from U.S. officials and everyone that I'm talking to who's in federal law enforcement and investigating this crime say that they have not yet found that connection. We've seen a lot of Twitter, a lot of tweets from pro-ISIS supporters who are applauding this particular attack. And ISIS is, in fact, a very anti-gay organization. If you are found to be gay and you are under the rule of ISIS in an area that ISIS has control of, they throw gay people off buildings to kill them. Oh, yeah. But at the same time, these tweets came out after the attack happened. And many of these pro-ISIS people will provide some sort of connection to ISIS by saying that they support the attack, but they've done that for attacks that have later come out to have nothing at all to do with
ISIS.
Okay,
so that's very important. I mean, not to get reaction from people who are pro-ISIS as necessarily saying that there was a connection to that group. Seems like a very important thing to keep in mind.
And unless some sort of detail came out before the attack itself happened.
Dina, do you think that it makes a difference in this whole discussion that the United States is in the middle of an election?
Well, that's interesting, because there's been a lot of discussion about whether or not ISIS or even Al-Qaeda, now we haven't even mentioned Al-Qaeda during this discussion, and that's a possibility as well, whether or not they want to put their thumb on the scale in the election by actually launching an attack before the election happens. There are a lot of people within the intelligence community that I've talked to who are quite worried that there could be an attack in the run-up to the election, so that, for example, that might help one candidate or the other. Certainly, there are members of ISIS who believe that Donald Trump would be the perfect candidate or the perfect president because of what he says. They would be able to perhaps get more recruits because of the way he talks about Muslims. But this is all sort of speculative. This is all what they're worrying about. There are no specific attacks that they have a line on, or no chatter that they have a line on that suggests that that's going to happen. But certainly that's something they've discussed. It's happened in the past. It happened in, I want to say, 2007 during the Madrid train bombings. There was an actual presidential election going on. The train bombings happened only shortly before the elections, and the more conservative candidate ended up winning.
It does seem, though, that that from what you said, that ISIS is enjoying the disruptiveness of this whole thing.
Absolutely, that's exactly what a terrorist organization is trying to do. That's their goal: is to frighten people and send political messages. And every single time there's something like this that happens, that happens. In the case of the San Bernardino attack, there was the most gossamer connection. between the two San Bernardino shooters and ISIS. About 40 minutes before the attack, they pledged allegiance or bayat to ISIS. Now, does that mean that it was ISIS-inspired? Does that mean they had great sort of trade craft, so they were keeping themselves mm-hmm. below mm-hmm. the radar? Or was it opportunistic? Because as soon as you say it's ISIS, people pay more attention.
Dina, thank you. We'll be coming back to you during the course of this broadcast. We're joined on the line now by Paul Brinkman of the Orlando Sentinel. He is in Orlando at the LGBT Center, which is not far at all from the nightclub. Paul, what is the scene there where you are right now?
There is a crowd here, probably, 100 people or so. They are a lot of volunteers here. There's a lot of people who brought in food. There are counselors, probably over a dozen counselors have come to volunteer their time. There are some friends of victims here who are seeking counseling support. They are also just trying to coordinate a response from the community. It's gotten busier and busier here throughout the day as people look for somewhere to go to help.
And Paul, we were talking to our counterterrorism correspondent, Dina Temple-Raston, who said that if indeed this was a man targeting Orlando's gay community, and of course we're still working through that, but this was known as one of the most popular gay nightclubs in Orlando. I just wonder, do people at the center where you are, do they feel at this point like they have been targeted here?
There's been no threats here. There are people outside, screening people that are coming in, and there is some security here. There are no police cars here right now. The police are apparently stretched pretty thin, but there are attempts to make the situation here secure.
I guess I wonder, do they feel that they were targeted in this shooting overnight?
Do they feel that the community was targeted?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's pretty much no doubt that it was because it was a gay bar.
And this is Gay Pride Month, and all kinds of things are going on in the community in addition to this. I mean, in addition to just having the sort of Saturday night celebration at a nightclub.
Yeah, last week was Gay Days here, which fills up a lot of hotels at around Disney. And there's a Pride Festival coming up soon, too. So, yeah, very much so.
And so what exactly is happening at this center, Paul? I mean, you said there are people who knew others who were in this nightclub. I mean, are they just there sort of giving each other support and waiting for updates on friends?
Yeah. Well, there's a couple of, there's a couple of rooms here. There are counselors in one of the back rooms that are meeting with people who feel they need support. I mean, there are people breaking down, crying periodically. Some of them may not even know someone directly that was there, but they're worried about somebody who might have been there, or they are just overwhelmed by the impact of such a heinous crime happening right in our community here.
All right, Paul, thank you very much. We'll be, I'm sure, returning to you throughout the morning. And let's return now to two of our colleagues who are in the studio. First, NPR's Eder Peralta. And Eder, important moment this morning. An imam came out to speak, and I guess it's worth sort of noting the significance of this, because as we're learning more about this young man, Omar Mateen, we don't know a lot yet, but there is the risk of sort of a rush to judgment, and probably a Muslim community that is worried about being targeted and wanting to get out in front of this and talk about, how awful they think this is. I mean, talk about what he said and what the significance of that is.
Yeah, and that's exactly what he was talking about. It was Imam Mohamed Morsi, the president of the Islamic Society of Central Florida. And he said it right off the bat. Let's not jump to conclusions here. Let's wait for the investigation to continue. But what he did is he put this in the broader context of mass shootings in the country. He said that, this society needs to do something, anything, to try and stop these mass shootings from happening. And he said that this one was one too many. You know, he called on people of other faiths to, you know, pray for the victims, and that's what he did.
Scott Detrow is also with us in the studio and waiting with us for the president to speak.
President Obama is expected to speak around 1:30. We've gotten early updates from the White House saying that President Obama has been briefed on the situation. He's spoken with his assistant on Homeland Security and counterterrorism. He's asked for updates from the FBI and other federal officials. But again, we're expecting to hear from President Obama in about a half hour or so. It'll be interesting to hear what he had to say. We've already gotten preliminary reactions from the two people who are hoping to replace President Obama in the White House. We're at the heat of a presidential campaign season, so it seems like every time there's news, it's filtered through the presidential campaign. Donald Trump, you talked about not wanting to make a rush to judgment, and a lot of law enforcement officials kind of hedging their characterization of the motivations of the shooter, what we know about this shooter. About 10 minutes ago, Donald Trump made a further statement saying that, I'll just read an exact quote, "Appreciate the congrats for being right on radical Islamic terrorism. I don't want congrats. I want toughness and vigilance. We must be smart." So Donald Trump linking this to radical Islamic terrorism. We're waiting to hear from federal law enforcement officials, from state law enforcement officials.
And as Dina Temple-Raston said, I mean, waiting to see if those connections, I mean, if they exist, how firm they are.
Absolutely.
If they exist at all. And that's an important thing to note that we don't know at this point. NPR's Scott Detrow and NPR's Ada Peralta, two of our colleagues who are doing all they can this morning to cover what is really a tragic story. Overnight at a nightclub in Orlando, Florida, a gunman opened fire, killing 50 people. There are 53 people in hospitals, some in critical condition, so those numbers could go up. And we'll be following this all morning. The President of the United States expected to speak in about a half hour. This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm David Greene.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer.